Hey, welcome back. Time for another episode of Confident ROI. The one show, maybe the only show you can confidently listen to and know you're going to get a real return on that investment. With the man who makes it happen each and every episode, as he always says, whether you work in a business, on a business, or for a business, he's done them all. Alex Verovio. Hey, Alex.
Hello, Paul.
Well, welcome back from the Northern Command here. I'm thrilled to have you in studio with your guest today here.
It was such a special guest, I had to come down.
Are you inspecting the troops down here or something and making sure that we're all doing what we're supposed to do here?
Making the holiday party run.
Oh, that's all it is. I thought you came here for us. There's a whole bunch of holiday parties you want to go to.
There's a number of birds getting it.
So who'd you bring with you today here?
I brought a very special guest. I've known him, I was thinking about it today, I think
94, 95 years you've known him?
Yeah, since 1994.
Oh, okay.
Back in the day when we had dial-up internet.
Yeah, wow. And, I remember those days.
And I brought him on because he knows something about the topic that a lot of people talk about but don't actually know what they're talking about.
That's what we were talking beforehand, and I'm confident today we're all going to learn something because it is a topic everybody throws around, big data, like they all know what it means, and I don't even know what the heck this is going to do or how it's going to change my life.
It's big data analytics, predictive analytics. My guest today is David Savowitz, the founder of Competitive Analytics, and he's been, Competitive Analytics has been around, 20 years, David?
Correct.
20 years, and he's been there when he's trying to explain what it is, and now it's a blossoming field, and he's growing his firm doing that. So we're going to talk about what is data analytics and a lot of these terms you're hearing about. And
now we were going to bring in a whiteboard, and he was going to diagram some algorithms for us, and I don't know if he's going to go there today, but
that might be in the appendix to the show.
The show notes.
There will be homework.
There will be homework. Well, David, welcome to Confident ROI.
Thank you for inviting me on.
Yeah, you weren't feeling good this week, and you have made an incredible effort to get here today. Anyone in the audience, you can see how good David looks today in spite of the challenge.
Well, the data drove me to drive here today.
The date. So, David, why don't you start? People throwing out data analytics, you probably hear it a lot. How are people using the tools and data analytics and that to improve their business and get an ROI?
Sure. So, when I first formed the company back in January of 2000, I was actually director of market research for the Irvine Company. I had a vision of building a business that really revolved around big data, although it wasn't called big data at the time, and really diving deep into what at the time was called statistical analysis, but now called analytics. And essentially, beyond the real estate realm, every industry, every company within every industry is really in dire need of internal and external data. Now, what do I mean by that? There's a large swath of data that most companies are completely unaware of that exists within their own company. I believe there's a statistic out there, I can kind of flip to it here, that 95% of businesses use only 5% of the value of their own data, which is staggering. Now, that may have improved just a bit over the last, say, 5-10 years, but by not by much. Most companies, and we work with many Fortune 100 companies all the way down to a lot of SMBs, they're unaware of really what data they have within their own realm. And furthermore, they really don't understand the data that's out there, the external data, the macroeconomics, the microeconomics, that truly drive and lead their business.
Can you give an example of a company that didn't realize what they were sitting on?
Sure. There's many. So for instance, in real estate, you look at the apartment market, and there's many large REITs, real estate investment trusts, and medium and smaller operators that obviously want to maximize occupancy, maximize rental rates, optimize profits. And they have this large, voluminous amount of lease data but it usually gets stored in a database, never to be seen again. And so I can talk for hours just on this topic, but essentially that data can help you analyze what rents you should set by unit, by floor plan, by the type of property, et cetera, et cetera. So that internal data by itself is a gold mine for companies. And there are companies that attempt to help them mine that data. The problem is it's twofold. One, you need data scientists to mine it and extract it and prepare it, create modeling tables, if you will. And then you need economists to actually decipher it and contextualize it.
Can you give an example, maybe some of the nuggets they've been able to sift out of there?
Well, sure. In fact, I'll give you an example that's personal to you. So you lived in Newport Beach at a community called the Meridian Newport Beach, built by the New Home Company. They had gone to five different consultants to help them, quote unquote, price their community. Their investment partners and their C-suite just didn't really feel comfortable with the consultant reports they were getting because it was the same old stuff, you know, just linear regression, Excel files with, you know, one axis showing price and the other axis showing square footage. So they then came to us and we said, yeah, we have very, we use machine learning. We use, instead of 10 or 12 community comps, we use millions of records of data. We're using AI and all sorts of different techniques that we've garnered from working with companies like Toyota, Macy's, Boeing, Yamaha. And so we developed a machine learning based price optimization model that helped them really price units for a lot more than they thought they could achieve, amassing obviously into the seven figures as far as higher profits that they thought they could get. And you happened to buy one of those units.
Thank you, David.
So that's just one of many, many examples about, you know, in this case, price optimization.
You took millions of records of data. So before, the old way of doing it is, okay, what's sold nearby? What are the prices? Maybe equate it to square footage. But how do you take millions of more records and make it relevant to your friend paying more for his?
Right. So that one of the first things that we do as a company is we tend to blow things up. The status quo.
In a good way?
Yeah, in a very good way. It's a creative destruction. We tend to believe, because we do use these tools as well, but then we find out quickly that they don't really work well. And again, if we stick with the real estate analog example here, you know, the Appraisal Institute has developed a method of valuation that they've been pretty much sticking with over the last 120 years, and it just doesn't work very well. So we just blew that up and developed our own valuation modeling, and not just for for sale housing or rental, but for evaluating the price of a motorcycle or an automobile. Another quick example, the largest auction house in the United States, National Power Sport Association, they hired us to build them a predictive pricing model that would allow them a more reliable forecast of when they would auction off a Harley Davidson or what have you. And their error rate was around 26%. And we got down quickly to about 12%. And then through another series of algorithms, we got it down to just a little over 6% error rate.
So you could predict what the Harley was going to auction for within 6% plus or minus.
Exactly. And in this way, you can imagine the power now of developing a pricing strategy, a pricing schema, if you will, that would enable the owner and the auction house to maximize profits. So it's in part taking what's traditionally been done and utilizing what works. And in a lot of ways, in this fast-changing economy, fewer and fewer things do work. But then looking at other new tools that are out there to leverage off of, to develop better tools, essentially. We often, and one of the unique parts of our business is we're multi-industry, so we're working in almost nearly every industry and sector. So when we developed an algorithm for a large retailer,
and what's an algorithm?
Algorithm is a fancy term for a formula. Okay, and we can develop a very intricate algorithm for, say, Macy's, you know, obviously large retailer, and then apply that to motorcycles or automobiles or healthcare. It's the ability to look cross-platform at solutions and take the best of what's available in different channels.
Is the data always coming from the client, or you go out there and grab data, get data, buy data?
It's both. So essentially, and you know, there's millions of horror stories and you know interesting factoids about the work that we do with the client's internal data. But yes, it all starts with their data. The joke that we have internally is that no matter how much a client tells us how great and clean their data is, it's never that way at all. It's usually a mess. And we're talking about from a Fortune 100 company all the way down to a small SMB.
And is that because it's in different databases or...
A variety of reasons. I mean, when you look at, I'll pull up another little helpful slide here. There are five dimensions of data. There's volume, variety, veracity, value, and velocity. This will be on your
the
quiz.
Five V's.
The five V's. There's actually nine, but for this morning, we just wanted to keep it simple and keep it with five V's. But generally, in the very beginning of any big data initiative or project, you really just want to get a hold of the data first and start understanding the dimensions, which is a fancy term for the field headers. What do you have? What do you, as you would say, I remember, you know, this is a famous Alex quote. What do you got? Stealing from an Al Pacino quote from Heat, I believe. And you want to find out what they have and start to understand the general quality and the scope of the data. A lot of times there's missing data. There's poor quality data. There's errors. So essentially, and this is an unknown fact about data, 80% of any analytics project, at least 80%, sometimes 90, is data prep. Okay? Anybody that tells you otherwise is lying or has no idea what they're doing. Because the data preparation phase is just absolutely foundational. The sexy part of data analytics is the interactive dashboards and the dials and the filters and the parameters, right? All the colorful charts that change automatically. Yeah, that's all cool. But long before that, there's an engine that sits underneath that needs to be, you know, clean. So the data prep piece is huge. And so to answer your question, the first part of a data analytics project is really to get a hold of the internal data, clean it, and prep it. Then there's an entire external operation or deciphering what's out there in the world that aligns and correlates and causates with that company's data. So that's another entire other area that a lot of people don't talk about because it's a huge, giant pain in the ass. We as a company have been doing this for the last 20 years. We have well over 1 million individual time series data indicators that we use. And we just launched a project in Canada and you know have another several hundred thousand from Canada and Europe as well. But that's another, what we call an overlay process, where you take a company's internal data and you overlay it with what's out there to understand what jives, what correlates.
Can you give us an example of that? So what were they taking internally and what could they combine?
I'll tell you an example that literally happened 5 days ago. So we're working with one of the largest Canadian operators and developers of apartments. They were skeptical about the number of external data drivers that exists in Canada. And I said, well, geez, you know, Canada's a pretty large country. I'd be shocked if they don't have...
It's like the population size of California.
Yeah, it's pretty large. And I said, I'd be shocked if there wasn't a lot of data out there. And sure enough, we found over 40 million records of Canadian time series data. Now, we obviously haven't had time to go through all of them yet, but we were in a demonstration and we showed their rent growth, their rental revenue, and we overlaid that with, just as an example, three different drivers. We found overall employment growth for, I believe it was 25 to 54-year-olds.
Is that a time series?
Time series data, and we overlaid...
So you can see how Canadian men, their careers progress.
Not men. I said employment. So
employment.
I'm going to get to that, though. You're coming. Right. So
okay.
We have all employment, you know, employment growth for men and women. And what we found is that there was a concurrent relationship, meaning when, you know, the overall total employment went up or down by a certain percentage, their rent growth would go down by a certain, go up or down a certain percentage. So then we, you know, replaced that indicator with just male employment, and we found that the male employment lagged their rent and revenue growth, which we thought was extremely fascinating. But then the final part of the demo was we then overlaid female employment growth, and it led. It's a leading indicator. And a very strong leading indicator. Now,
so if the female's making more money, they're going to be spending more on rent beforehand?
Right. Well, that's an income dimension, which is another indicator. And you bring up a really good point, because then you can overlay employment with income with an internal driver such as revenue growth. There are two ways. I'm going to back up a bit. There are two ways to really examine and decipher what external indicators right, really matter to your company, which will then help ROI, which is why we're here talking on the radio, right?
Exactly.
Is that, you know, there's the science of it, building algorithms. We built an algorithm that looks at all these hundreds of thousands of indicators and automatically overlays them and then shifts them forward and backwards and then, you know, creates a correlation ranking table. But there's another human piece or dimension, I should say, to how this is done. And that's creating a visual, you know, dual trend line overlay chart and then just flipping through intuitively what you believe may be important, like employment. And so that was done in a very intuitive way. So there's just kind of two ways to do analytics. In fact, you know, we teach a course now at UCI, the new Masters of Analytics program at University of California, Irvine. And I teach with my Director of Analytics, Michael Ponton. We teach a course formerly called Mastering Predictive Analytics, now called The Art and Science of Applied Forecasting. It's a mouthful. But we teach our students the art and the science of analytics. It's not just like learning an algorithm or a fancy formula and jamming into a piece of software, throwing the data in and spitting out an answer. There's definitely an art and a qualitative piece to analytics. So in this last example, creating or throwing paint on a wall and examining different trend lines or creating different charts to see what possibly pops up is kind of an important part of the process.
All right. Well, we're coming up on our break here. We can go a little deeper there and talk about how you take the science and the art of it to come up with something beautiful and some insight.
Awesome.
When you use the Premier Rewards Gold Card from American Express, the rewards points can keep on multiplying. By 3 with triple points on airfare. By 2 with double points on gas and groceries. And a single point for pretty much every other dollar you spend on the card. Then, start choosing from over a million rewards to redeem all those points. Apply today and the annual fee for the first year is on us. Call 1-800-AXP-GOLD or visit AXPGold.com. The annual fee for the card is $175. See terms, conditions, and restrictions at AXPGold.com.
I'm on the observation deck of the Empire State Building to demonstrate how much material Waste Management recycles. As North America's largest residential recycler, last year alone, Waste Management recycled 12.9 million tons. How much is that? Let's do the math. Carry the 6. It's enough to fill this building more than 27 times. With experience like that, we're bound to have a program that can help your business recycle. Talk to Waste Management or visit thinkgreen.com.
All right, we're back with Alex and his guest, and I am just chomping to ask so many questions here, but I'm going to restrict myself to one or two. When we started the show, we were first off air, I asked the question that I hear all the time on this business channel, and that's this. The coming Internet of Things. Everything is going to be connected to the Internet and send data back to the manufacturer. How many times that toaster worked? How many times maybe it popped up white bread or brown bread or whatever? All this data that is going to be suddenly available and collected automatically. Whose job in the company is it to gather it, digest it, and make sense of it? Is it the marketing's department, because they've got to make some decisions? Is it the sales department, or is it some new group of people that are trying to do this? Whose job is it to gather it and make sense of it and decipher it?
It's the new group.
The new group.
It's not sales. It's not marketing.
But won't they want to do it? They're the ones that are saying, the toaster's popping up white bread more than we thought. We should contact a white bread manufacturer and create a strategic alliance, or we should include Wonder Bread in our ads because everybody's using it for that, or they're using it for some purpose I never thought of. We should change our whole marketing campaign.
There's a difference between usage and responsibility. Mm. They absolutely should and want to use it on a daily, if not hourly, basis. But being responsible for it? No, absolutely not. And that actually includes IT as well.
That's what I'm trying to think of, IT.
Yeah, right. No, IT is, and for all you IT guys out there, we love you, we respect you, you're awesome, but you're not economists and you're not data scientists. Keep the networking.
Get the plumbing working.
Get the plumbing working, exactly. Make sure my computer, my software is working.
And aren't each of these three groups going to fight for it? Hey, I'm the IT guy. I'm the only one that should be technically oriented. I'm the one that understands this stuff, even though they don't. They know how to connect nodes, but they may not understand how to analyze data.
What we see is every department is fighting for it. they all want the new realm, the new sexy job, or the new, you know, function of data analytics.
The added budget dollars, right?
Yeah.
And they want the budget dollars. What the CEO or the C-suite needs to do is realize that this deserves its own silo, its complete own responsibility. You know, that's why you see cropping up a chief data officer, right? You see the CDO. You've got a chief analytics officer. You see those starting to pop up here and there. And I think those are the companies that get it. Again, outside the realm of IT, outside of sales and marketing, they're users of the data and analytics, not the purveyors or the, you know, the responsible.
I'm going to use an old analogy you have to go look up. They're not the oracles of Delphi. They're not the ones that get to sit and swirl the tea leaves together and figure out what this is saying.
Here, to talk about a story here. So a few weeks ago, I went to one of my, I think it was the best conference I ever went to in my life. And I'm a member of the National Association of Business Economists. They had a tech conference up in San Francisco, and I got to meet the chief economists of Google, Netflix, Uber, Amazon. Actually, I believe Amazon has 5 chief economists.
Wow.
Not exaggerating.
Who knew? I didn't know they had one. Yeah,
and,
right.
And apparently, you know, the rumor has it that Amazon hires more economists than any other organization in the world. But anyway,
really?
That's
more than
the
CIA.
That's a little bit of a, you know, more than the Commerce Department. Just a rumor. But what's important and what I learned is that, you know, having economists and data scientists in every part of the company is going to be critical. But again, those are users of the data, users of economics, not the department that's really the responsibility to hone and prepare and create what we call modeling tables and getting the foundational analytics set so that others can use it to their advantage. So for instance, you know, the sales and marketing team, they're going to want sales and marketing dashboards replete with a lot of analytical capabilities, but they're not going to certainly have the ability to build those, right? That's kind of our take on it, and that's what we're kind of seeing. We see a lot of issues when companies don't follow that. The sales and marketing people want to buy what's kind of known today as self-serve analytics. It's a term that probably your listeners haven't heard yet, but there's this push for the theory that anyone can actually create their own analytics. And to some extent, that's very true. The tools out there are phenomenal. And, you know, they talk about the citizen data scientist being able to buy some software, load up their own data, and do what they want to do. And that's true. But when you're talking about a company, small, medium, or large, typically in this day and age of specialization, you want to stick to selling if you're in the sales. If you're in marketing, you want to stick to marketing. You don't want to start building algorithms, if you will. The self-serve sort of push is really big right now, but you really do need a special department in the company that really deals with data science and economics.
And is that at a certain size when once they're starting to, Amazon obviously uses all the information. Anytime I'm dealing with Amazon, they're watching, right?
Absolutely.
And they're figuring out, and Google's watching what I click on and how long I'm there. And so there, somebody's trying to capture that and then have that in a format that the algorithms can spit out, okay, here's where we lost them.
Yeah, and I think a lot of people don't get what I'm about to say is that who analyzes the information, collects it, preps it, analyzes it, builds algorithms, that's the data scientists, essentially. But then after that's over, you have the economists come in and contextualize it. What is this going to mean, and what are the decisions that we need to contemplate to increase and enhance ROI? That's an economist's job. And I always go back to a classic example. Go back to price optimization. You have a company that wants to optimize their prices, whether it's services or products.
You want to charge me more for my condo.
Right, or less. Sometimes you want to bring the price down to increase volume, right? So you have a data guy who has state-of-the-art software, and he knows how to collect data and analyze it, and he uses R as a program, and you know he's got all his tools and algorithms at his beck and call. But then you say, okay, do you know what elasticity is? And they sort of raise their eyebrow and go, huh? Yeah, I kind of heard that in Economics 401 one time. How can that person, who may be the best data scientist you can possibly have, drive and build a price optimization model if they don't even understand the foundational concepts of elasticity.
And elasticity being the more you charge, the less people buy.
Right. That's just a simple, that's a fancy term for, you know, understanding the relationship between price and quantity. But there are many, many other foundational macro and microeconomic models and tools that are outside of the data science realm that should stay there, because there's very few of these rainbow colored unicorns that are both data, you know, data science extraordinaire and economist extraordinaire.
So, kind of taking the example, we watched the movie about the CIA. There's gathering raw data and what's going on, voice data and things like that. But if you harness the data and you have it, then you have an analyst trying to make sense of it. Okay, what does this picture mean? What's going on? You know, are they building missile silos? Or
the former, the data scientist. The latter example you mentioned, that's the economist.
And the data scientist, are they the ones getting the data?
That's correct. They would. And we're using two terms in a very broad sense, because there's a lot of roles and layered responsibilities within each of those, but we're just kind of breaking it down into two archetypes, if you will.
Got it.
So my question is, as everybody starts to use it, how do you know they're not misusing it? How do you know that their own internal bias isn't coming into play and they're picking and choosing the facts that already prove what they believed? I think this marketing is a great program. Here, I'm going to pick the few data points that show that. Somebody else is going to say, no, I'm in sales and I'm going to prove that the marketing sucks and the leads are worthless. The economist is going to say, I think this is all leading us to this conclusion. And somebody else says, but you're forgetting these four other factors and these five overlays to change your conclusion.
Well, the answer is easy. They are misleading. They are misusing it, bottom line. And let me explain why. The field of data and analytics is just really exciting. You know, from Moneyball, you know, all the way to, you know, a decade later and all the amazing tools and availability of big data.
Now, who thought they'd use data to figure out how to build a better baseball team?
Yeah, yeah. That was Billy Bean.
Well, he actually did, right? The guy who's the guy out in Boston, there was a guy who wrote the book on data analytics, right? And Billy Bean really just took it and applied it. He was a businessman looking for some sort of edge. He had constraints on his business. He couldn't afford to pay as much as the New York Yankees did for players. So he had to come up with something. So he was really grasping at straws, right?
Well, so let me just first answer the first piece to that. As we have a caller coming in.
We got a caller on line four.
All right. This is a popular show here. I can take that call if you want. So why I say that it's being misused, and let me explain something that is unfortunately the dark side of data and analytics right now, and nobody's talking about it. So you've got this wonderful data.
We do here. We're confident to talk about these topics.
Right. Okay. That's true. That's why you have me on, right?
That's right.
So you've got, you know, access to lots of data and the most amazing tools in the world. And you've got data scientists and economists, et cetera, et cetera. Fallacy is that you're going to come up with a model or something that's going to be bulletproof and robust because you took your data, you threw it into algorithm A, and you created an output B. What we found out, because we've been doing this a long time, is that you really need to have a lot of humility. And what we find, unfortunately, in the IT realm and data scientists and economists, well, they might be, you know, very, repose and in a quiet personality. There's a lot of arrogance out there. And so what you have to do is have a lot of humility and think, you know what? I just built this model for Toyota or Honda or Boeing or whomever. How do you know it's right? You know, a single data set, a single algorithm, a single set of formulas, a single set of weights, right? I can go on and on and on, right?
Right.
A single scenario is what I'm driving at. How do you know it's the right one for this use case, for this company, for this geospatial area, et cetera, et cetera? People don't ask that question. They take the data, they put it in a model, they throw out the output, they show the CEO, here's the answer. Growth next year is going to be 4%. And no questions are really asked, but they just assume that the black box is working. There's a term called scenario analysis or ensemble modeling. And what those...
Just talking about that this morning over coffee with my wife here. Just talking about both of those. It's ironic.
It's a very, very popular topic. No, actually, nobody's talking about this. And so what it really tells you is that if you go into this with a lot of humility and you establish the fact that you don't know what you don't know, and you use multiple data sources. Or maybe you take one data source and you bifurcate it and you take this part of the data and you take this part of the data and you run some analysis with Model A and then Model B and Model C and you use different weights and different parameters. You follow what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. You literally could then, instead of having a singular output, you would then create 500,000 different potential outputs. This is kind of analogous to Monte Carlo simulation, but slightly different. And so when you do that, and by the way, you talked about the long tail before we gone on,
yeah,
on the air here.
Meaning that it accumulates over a long period of time. It doesn't play out instantly here.
Right. So you basically, you know, a long tail is just a form of a distribution curve. So you take all your output and you throw them into a big distribution curve, and the gravitational force of what occurs at the median, or reversion to the mean, is really the model components that you want to use for your quote-unquote final output, or your expected value, if you will. Now, that's a huge pain in the neck to do. It takes a lot more work than just, hey, I'm a data scientist, and I've got this really great piece of software. I got this really nice data. I'm going to create this one singular nice algorithm that I, you know, copied and pasted off the web, and here's my answer. You know, it doesn't work that way. So part of the art and science of this is using ensemble modeling or building multiple models, multiple data sets, multiple variables, so that you can see the landscape of possibilities. We don't know of anyone really focusing on doing this. Now, a small company doesn't have to do what we do, right? Well, they can just hire us and we can do it for them. Or they can have the ability to just generate two or three or four scenarios. And then they can understand their competitors or their landscape or their pricing or their demand in a more of a broader sense, where they can understand what's the worst case scenario, what's the best case, and what's the expect, what can I expect within a probability percentage that's going to happen next year for this product, for this service, what have you. So that's sort of the shadow side of what's not really getting discussed out there, because the tools are so powerful. Right?
Mm-hmm.
And it is becoming easier and easier. People are forgetting about the kitchen work. They're forgetting about the janitorial work, is what we call, you know, of data scientists, really prepping the data, running,
it tastes good.
Yeah, running multiple scenarios, etc. So anyway.
So I give you an example?
Sure.
Of where good data goes bad and everybody convinces themselves that one thing's going to happen, and in fact, the opposite happens. It was called the Great Recession, and the derivatives from which it all derived. This idea that you could package bad loans and cut them up and chop them up. First of all, you could create a series of bad loans, and then you could insure against them. AIG or whatever was going to insure all these things. So don't worry about it. Then we can package them and sell them, so I'm going to get them off my desk. And they created this whole system. And somewhere along the way, I don't understand it, but somewhere along the way, all these giant financial institutions convinced themselves this was okay, until it wasn't.
And that was because a data scientist decided to look into the boring task of pouring through all those financials. Remember?
Mm-hmm.
They even made a movie about that.
And so, but again, at some point, somebody was relying on some data scientist's report to say what they were doing with this new financial instrument, how they structured it, how they hedged it, how they protected and insured it. This was all okay. I'm always thinking of the guy who goes up in Malibu who has a house that falls down every year, and then he goes and gets a geologist to tell him this way it's going to not fall down, and then it just falls down again. And if you don't like that report, go get another one.
Well, it's not going to fall down unless you get an 80-year rainstorm.
Yeah, maybe. But it just seems like sometimes you can manipulate the data to tell you anything you want to believe.
Well, there's a book back in 1956, I believe, called How to Lie with Statistics.
Yeah, right.
So,
exactly.
You know, I encourage your audience to...
So somehow we think we're smarter and we're prepared. Our elections. Look at all the election shocks we've had. First Obama and then Trump, you know. And over and over again, people said this can't happen. And yet, they both turned out groups of people that historically had never voted. It invalidated the models.
Well, let me caveat that by saying that my hero, Nate Silver,
500.com, yes,
right. mentioned
a great one.
His models didn't fail. They were within the standard of error. So if you look at that, was it on the outskirts of the error range? Sure. But the model still operated. It was just, you know, when you roll the dice, two die, and you get a 12, well, that's not within the realm of probability, but it's in the realm of possibility.
Yeah. I guess I'm just saying you have to be, how do we ensure, we somehow think we've got data backing us now, so therefore we're going to make big bets. financial bets, political bets, business bets. And if we don't really understand the data well enough, or if we're not looking at the outlier, the other facts that weren't convenient that we somehow swept out of the model because it somehow seemed to be an anomaly and I didn't quite understand that, so let's just get rid of that little inconvenient fact, we can instantly convince ourselves that wrong is right and up is down.
Well, can I quote Spider-Man?
Please, yeah. We love Spider-Man. You see Spider-Man on the wall up there?
You know, I think your audience knows what's coming, but, you know, with great power, which is what data and analytics provides you, comes great responsibility. And I don't think, per the last sort of, you know, soliloquy I just went through, people are paying attention to the responsibility function of data and analytics. It's not an automatic, instant gratification field. Just like with anything, you have to really understand the weaknesses and strengths.
But it gets back to your earlier examples with auctioning off motorcycles. You went from a 24% error rate, that's a big range, plus or minus, down to 6%. Mm-hmm. So it's not necessarily getting one right answer, but refining your range and understanding what is likely to happen. And you talked about the rent growth in Canada, and that, hey, it's different between men and women and how they react when their incomes are changing. And so it's not one answer. If incomes go up, well, it depends. If for whom and...
And that'll change, too. Because 2 years from now, that relationship might flip. And so it's a constant... It's a perpetual vigilance of looking at data.
And that's what happened in baseball, right? That everyone's... It's almost a game theory where... Okay, if everyone's looking for people they can get on base, now all of a sudden those become more expensive and the advantage isn't there. Now you have to change what you're looking for.
Well, so Moneyball introduced the importance of on-base percentage, but now the in-vogue statistic is launch angle, right? And so, you know, that's why the Oakland
A's launching missiles.
Yeah, that's why the Oakland A's are relevant again, because they took a look at the data and they're just using it. Again, like no other team.
What is launch? Somebody just tweeted, what is launch data?
Launch angle.
Or launch angle, right.
So launch angle is when the ball, when the bat strikes the ball, what is the angle that the ball is leaving the bat?
Oh, my God.
And so
there's... You can measure that, monitor that?
They have that data now. They actually have data in which when a ball is struck into the outfield, they can measure an outfielder's reaction time and its curvature to the path of the ball. You know, are they taking a more linear path or are they taking a more curvy linear path?
You mean when they're running to catch the ball?
When they're running to catch the ball. Because who would you rather want? Someone with the same... You'd have two outfielders you're assessing. They both have the same speed, right? They both have the same glove, but yet one runs in a more linear fashion towards the ball, whereas one's running in a more curvy linear path. You want the guy that runs in a more linear path.
Oh my. Sorry, we can't renew your contract because you're running in a curvy linear path here.
And
Alex runs straighter faster to the ball.
That's Moneyball, too. That's the second generation of what a lot of ball teams are using now. So,
And is that, did they come across it? And you're talking about algorithms and AI, artificial intelligence, trying to learn things. Were they looking at, okay, we're gathering this data, what inside all this data, launch angles, how they run, what could be predictive of a better baseball play?
Great question. And that is ideally what everybody's objective is you have all this data. So the next step is you got to analyze it all, because for some teams, maybe launch angle is not pertinent because of the way they play or the stadium or the, you know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So you have to then... apply that to your own context, to your own company, to your own organization. Again, this goes back to ensemble modeling and perpetually analyzing, because what may work today, what may correlate and causate right now over the next 6 months will change. We have a client, one of the largest real estate developers in the U.S., and you know they were always used to looking at our key external drivers. And then you know recently, about 6 months ago, we kicked two of them out because they just weren't correlating very well, and they got mad at us. Like, what are you doing? You know, where is unemployment rate? We always like to look at unemployment rate. We said, well, that no longer correlates with your business anymore. So if you want to look at it, sure, we'll throw you a chart. But as far as predictive ability, you got to change. You got to change with, you know.
Because you can be tracking too many things.
Correct. You could.
Or the wrong things, as you're saying.
That's right. Because it's correlation and causation, which I'm sure a lot of your audience understands.
We're going to last break here.
All right. Last fast break here. We're going to throw a fastball at you and come back with some more hardball questions after this.
Imagine what it would feel like to lose everything. Your job, your home, your family, your dignity. This has happened to thousands of the men, women, veterans, and young adults we serve at Working Wardrobes. What do we do to help? We provide career development services, life skills workshops, job skills training. We provide the perfect interview outfit, and we get clients placed in jobs. Call Working Wardrobes, 714-210-2460. Donate, volunteer, invest. Higher.
While we're all laughing and debating the next questions to throw at him here, we want to remind you that there is a magazine, Confident ROI, the fall issue's out, and in it you can discover the right tools to advance your company, because this is the human power issue. Forget that dirty data. We're back to humans here. And Google's unexpected discovery about humans.
So they actually use data for
they
that.
They use data to analyze humans here. It's a great book on tribal leadership, something we're hearing a lot about. So if you want to understand how to take your company to the next level with confidence, pick up a copy of ConfidentROI.com. All right, back to that. So what's it? We figured out the real hardball question to throw at him here. I got a couple in mind here.
Go ahead, Paul.
All right. Well, just that, you know, what we were talking about before. Are you using bad data to make future predictions here? And how do you know that you're looking at the right stuff and not the wrong stuff here?
Can I throw a technical term out that
Please.
Just popped into my head?
Just define it.
In analytics, in predictive analytics, there is a technique that uses what's called a confusion matrix.
Mm. I'm confused already.
Yeah, I know. And so when you say...
That's how we charge the clients more.
Yeah.
When our confusion coefficient is optimized...
Your rates go up.
It's actually,
your value goes up.
It's actually really simple. So, because you said, you know, maybe we're using bad data, but it's telling us some things that we should be doing, right? So, essentially, what a confusion matrix is, it gives you four scenarios. It tells you, one, you know, it's giving you a false positive. It's saying, you know, guess what? It's telling you to do something that's going to lead to the wrong answer.
Yeah.
Right? You could have something in which it's telling you to do something and it's leading you into the correct answer.
Right.
And then the data might lead you, conversely, there's two other scenarios. The data is showing you there's a negative implication and it's showing you that really, if you follow that, it's actually going to show you what to do. And then the fourth scenario is what, you know, the negative implication is basically driving that you shouldn't do something, which is the correct way to do that. So there is positive data telling you to do something correctly. That's what you want to follow. And then when the good data drives you to do something that you know you shouldn't do, and that's correct as well. But there are two.
That's correct as well. So the good data is giving you the wrong result.
Those are two scenarios where the good data is giving you the right answer, the wrong answer, and then the wrong data is giving you the right and the wrong answer as well.
Yeah.
And so essentially, your bad data could lead you into a positive outcome, but you don't want to follow that because those are aberrative. And so that's what leads a lot of people into poor decisions as well.
Aberrative meaning that it's really not a predictor of the future.
Well,
it's just a one-off.
When you have bad data and you use it and something turns out well for your company or your organization,
you want to use that secret thing again.
It's an illusion. And so, but you're thinking that your bad data is driving a good decision when it's not.
It's kind of like a superstition.
Kind of like a superstition.
Right.
Yeah, exactly.
So anyways,
right.
So you
That's
have to.
Thinking.
So you need some people to understand the difference and understand what a confusion is.
So let me give you one other example, then I'll shut up here. We had somebody in a while ago who is the chief, I think he's the chief data officer for the city of Los Angeles. And if I remember this correctly, there's only four or five major cities doing this. I think San Diego is another one, where they've hired a chief data officer. And he said, the first thing is we got to realize we have millions of potential points of collection. And one example he gave was parking meters. Parking meters are all connected to the internet now because they got to charge your credit card. So what could we be doing? We should be monitoring that usage. But he said, but we're smart enough to know we don't know what to do with that data. So maybe in their example, they made it available to the public. In fact, they had meetings. Come on in. We'll show you the kind of crazy data we're collecting. Figure out what to do with it. And some young guy developed an app from it you can download. You're in busy downtown Los Angeles. You're looking for that open parking meter. You can go on his app because they're measuring it in real time. They didn't mean to be, but it's online. We might as well add some little thing that measures which one's open and which one's not. And then he collects the data and turns it into an app so you can instantly reserve it and go grab it and do it. And they said they thought that was a brilliant idea of using data to make the city function better. It wasn't something they came up with. They just came up with the idea of let's collect the data and throw it out. Is data ever going to be open from companies like that? Are they going to say, let's see what you can do with our toaster data. We can't figure out what to do with it, or our refrigerator data, or whatever else we're collecting on the internet now.
That's a great question. And the answer is yes. I mean, there are lots of opportunities for an organization that all of a sudden realizes, wow, you know, we build toasters, but we have an amazing asset here. It's called our data. They're probably not in a position to really understand how to monetize it.
Right.
But there are companies out there.
Data, we're collecting all this usage from our toasters. We don't know what to do with it. We've already got what we think is valuable, but we'll throw it out and see if somebody else can come up with something clever.
Well, I heard that IBM was putting out big data sets on GitHub and also tools to analyze it. And they're encouraging people, hey, go see what you can find these data sets.
Well, mine it. See if you can find some gold we missed here. Yeah.
And then there's a whole other dimension, too. Outside of an organization, there's social media or social proof, if you will. The app Waze is reliant on just drivers driving down the road saying, oh, there's an accident here. I think I'll input that into my Waze app so other people can realize that there's an accident 4.2 minutes from where they are. So
crowdfunding data. The crowd is presenting data into the system here.
Yeah. I have a slide up here that I brought up I want to share with your audience.
Sure.
That kind of brings to bear how quickly data can amass. So if you can imagine just 12 dimensions of data, let's just say you've got an organization with a product.
Okay.
Right, and your product.
You make that so easy. I can't mention two dimensions.
All right, well,
you got 12. You're playing 12-dimensional chess here.
A lot of dimensions.
You got a product and you want to, you know, track its sales and where it sells and et cetera,
et cetera. Who buys it?
Who buys it, right? Companies have tens of thousands of dimensions, right? And so just looking at 12, right? Just giving you your audience here a little quick math primer. If you look at paired combinations of those 12 distinct.
How many pairs can you make with 12 sets of data, right?
Exactly. It's 66. Okay. I think Excel can handle that pretty well, right? if you look at combinations, right, you come up with about 4,095.
And how's a combination different than a pair? Combinations more than two?
Yeah, more than two.
Right.
Right? Individual, but yet distinct combinations of the 12. But if you look at all permutations in which order is also important, right? And every type of permutation by count and order.
Order meaning, so 1 plus 2 plus 12, but maybe it's 2 plus 1 plus 12.
You got it.
Put it in the order.
Exactly. And that can include, you know, analogously weights.
Right. Because unlike math, it matters what order you put them. If I add 2 and 1 and 12, or 1 and 2 and 12, I still get the same result. But if I put the data in a different order,
correct,
I come up with a different result.
So again, you know, paired combination 66, all combinations 4,095, all permutations over 1.3 billion.
Oh, jeez.
So you can't do that with Excel, okay? You need to have high-powered software to churn through that data. And that's the only way you're going to understand that this specific permutation of your product or your service or these outside, you know, indicators are the key metrics you should be looking at.
Well, and that's where you're bringing back to that example of the motorcycle auction. You're looking at, okay, what permutations are relevant to pricing this motorcycle before it goes on auction.
That's exactly right. Like a CC, the year built, the model, the make, you know, and they were over.
The time of the year might matter.
That's right. The place that it gets auctioned. So in this case, getting back to that word dimensions, there was over 100 different variables or dimensions that
you
have to look at.
The human have to decide how many dimensions you're going to look at. And you said you went to some apartment thing and they wanted to look at employment. They thought that was an important dimension. And when you analyze it, it ain't that important anymore.
So, okay, let's talk about this in two ways. One, let the computer do all that work. But that said, the politics, right, and the art and science of analytics, you need to take that into account. Why? Because you have a CEO that is absolutely convinced and doesn't care about computers or analytics that the LIBOR rate is absolutely right. Something that he's been looking at for 35 years and
right.
He knows it drives his business. Whatever. It's like a dog with a bone, and he's not going to release that bone. So you can't tell them.
He thinks tire size is important in a motorcycle making decision. So he's always going to look at tire size or
whatever. Yeah, exactly. And so you can't just tell them he's wrong or she's wrong. So
Alex does every week. Yeah.
So you have to. I learned the hard way. You know, you have to present your analytics in a way that sometimes gently evolves the thinking in a company. Now, that said, it's okay to look at tire size and continue to keep that in your dashboard or your analytics, where day after day, week after week, month after month, they look at it and realize and make their own decision. Oh, yeah, this is really not, it's not impacting
anything.
The model. But you incorporate it in there and let them come to the conclusion that you already know.
So you're talking about the politics of presenting data.
These are the politics. But now the science of innovating models and using analytics is that nobody really knows, though, what's going to be the correlative, highly indicator that really drives the company, say, in the next 12 years. Because you're only going to know that 12 years or 12 months later. So that's where a little bit of the art comes in, where you say, look, you know what? We stopped using unemployment, but we're entering a new cycle, and unemployment may become once again a highly correlated driver. So let's start looking at it, because our intuition, right, our experience matters. And so analytics does not replace the C-suite experience, intuition. I think we just got a lightning
bolt. Yeah, we're getting hit by something
there.
Here, yeah.
Or maybe...
Well, I think it's the big fella's way of saying we should wrap up.
I think so. We're at the end.
So David, we covered a lot of great stuff today. People are interested in talking competitive analytics. How can they do that?
Well, you can go to our website, competitiveanalytics.com, just like I always say, just like you spell the two words, competitiveanalytics.com, or you can email us at info@competitiveanalytics.com. We'll be happy to field any questions you may have.
Thanks, David.
And how do they reach Confident ROI?
Confident ROI at confidentroi.com.
Well, I'm confident if everybody listens to this two or three times like I'm going to, you're going to learn something. You're going to get some insights that you didn't have before. Thanks for coming on today.
You're very welcome.
You've been listening to Confident ROI right here on the OCTalkRadio.net. For at-home listeners, at-work listeners, like you.